World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
Supreme Allied Headquarters reports that the Americans have begun a general advance on a 30-mile front in France today with terrific support from the Air Command. There was also another heavy bombing of the southern French coast, the kind that in the past has preceded landing operations. On the Eastern Front, Berlin acknowledges that German troops are withdrawing at certain points from the Carpathian to the Baltic, and there are indications the Russians are about to step up the speed of their offensive once again. In Italy, the city of Empoli, west of Florence, has fallen to the Eighth Army without a fight. The Allies are rushing food and medical supplies to Florence, civilians, despite continual enemy sniping. In the Far East, Chungking says heavy fighting is going on in the Hunan province in the southern suburbs of the rail city of Hongyang, where the Japs are trying to dislodge stubborn Chinese defenders. And now for news sent direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London, Richard C. Hottolet reporting.
The Germans are trying to pull their forces out of the Allied trap in western France today. Since yesterday afternoon, German infantry, armor, motor, transport, and horse-drawn equipment have been crowding the few remaining roads that lead out through the Falaise Gap. Something like 100,000 men and several hundred tanks are trying to get out. And all this time, during every hour of daylight, these choked roads have been bombed, machine-gunned, and hit by the rockets of all the medium and fighter bombers we could put into the air. Correspondents at the front have described the bombs cascading down from planes glistening in the sun. And the Germans' only protection has been the dust of their escape. The Germans indicate today that they not only have their 7th Army in this threatened area, but also their 5th. We don't know much about this 5th Army, except that it was raised in the West at the beginning of the war and then disbanded. Meanwhile, the gap through which the Germans are trying to escape is being narrowed down. The American column pushing north from Alençon is still operating behind a security curtain, but the Germans have made several admissions that reveal its progress. For one thing, the enemy says that it's pushed on several miles beyond Alençon toward Falaise. And another enemy report says that already Alençon is a base for strong concentrations, not only of American armor and motorized equipment, but also of our infantry. There are now only about 30 miles of escape gap left for the Germans, and with this American strength in the area, we can be sure that it's in the process of being narrowed down right now. Up on the northern jaw of the trap, the Germans have been fighting desperately to prevent the British and Canadians from advancing on Falaise. So far, they've been successful. But they haven't been able to prevent our allies from cleaning out a German salient between the Orne and Blaise rivers. Here, British and Canadian and Polish forces now combined, and with German pockets cleared up, are putting on increasing pressure today. Although things are bad for the Germans, there's no sign yet that their withdrawal is a rout. Correspondents say that massed artillery and some tank formations are fighting determined rearguard actions, and that supplies for these troops continue to go in as the retreating columns seek a way out. Everywhere, the Germans seem to be fighting courageously. At the bottom of the bag, between Ville and Mortain, we've advanced on a wide front, taking the town of Saudevaz. This is as much German withdrawal, though, as it is our advance. The Germans are racing against disaster. A message from von Kluge's headquarters says that the decisive battle of the entire invasion campaign may take place in the near future. And this seems to be true no matter what happens between Veer and Falaise. Our command is not losing sight of the possibility that the Germans may rescue some of their forces from the Allied trap. But rescue is hardly the right word, because they'll then be caught this side of the Seine. Already, General Eisenhower is taking steps to make sure that the German 5th and 7th armies are caught and crushed in western France. He's trying to make the line of the Seine impassable both to the retreating Germans and to any reserves they have on the other side. Today, more than 1,250 heavy bombers blasted highways and railroads on both sides of the Seine from Paris down to its estuary. It certainly looks as if the Allied pincer movement is double-barreled. The Germans yesterday held a show of strength in Paris. What's described as a great many troops and full field equipment paraded through the streets. The purpose, as the Germans explain it, was to show the Parisians who was still in charge. Apparently, the Parisians have been getting more and more exuberant with the approach of the Allies, and florists have been doing big business selling flowers to be thrown at our troops as they march into the capital. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation. Radio has done more to stimulate the appreciation of good music than any other medium. Admiral Corporation is proud of the part it has played in America's musical life. The needs of war now occupy Admiral's full efforts in producing vital radar and electronic equipment. When peace returns, however, you can have a new Admiral radio in your home. Some of these fine new models of Admiral radios and radio phonographs will provide the matchless reception possible only with FM. When the practicability of television has been proved, Admiral television sets will open the door to an entirely new world of enjoyment. Post-war, your choice may be made from a wide range of sizes and styles, from the Admiral Bantam or personal type receiver to the superb models of combinations made in the great modern factories of Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
Europe's Eastern Front is showing signs of breaking into movement today, which may quickly sweep the Russians into Warsaw and East Prussia. A German military commentator has admitted that Russian attacks against the Hungarians were only partly repelled as the Soviets renewed their pressure towards Slovakia and Hungary. And east and north of Warsaw, a Russian tank attack forced a German retreat of several miles. The Germans also admitted fresh Russian gains northwest of Bialystok. And now for a summary of the military situation in that part of the world, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
Activities on the Russian front continue to center along the frontiers of East Prussia and in the area southwest of Sandomierz, where the Russians are trying to widen and deepen their bridgehead over the upper Vistula River. Let's take a quick look at this front from north to south. In the extreme north, we find the Russians widening the corridor, which cuts off the German army group of General Lindemann in Estonia and Latvia. Early last week, Lindemann made one rather feeble attempt to break out, which failed. On the western flank of this corridor, the Russians are now pushing toward the Baltic coast, evidently with the purpose of taking Libau and Memel, and then swinging southward to attack the northern frontier of East Prussia along the River Niemen. On the eastern approaches to East Prussia, very strong German counterattacks have checked the Russian advance opposite the Insterberg Gap between the River Niemen and the Masurian Lake. Round to the southwest, the Russians from the direction of Bialystok are making slow but on the whole steady gains in the direction of the fortress of Ossowice, which guards the East Prussian frontier in this sector. East of Warsaw, the Russians are working their way northwestward from the general area of the town of Chatelty, and are approaching the strong German positions along the Narev River. They do not appear to have reached the river anywhere on this part of the front. The fight of the Polish underground forces in Warsaw is still going on, but no help appears to be reaching them, and it is doubtful whether they can be given effective support unless the Russians can break down the eastern defenses of the Polish capital within the next few days. Farther south along the Vistula, there is no very great activity until the area of Sandomierz is reached. Southwest of that town, the Russians are making their greatest threat at the moment. They have a deep bridgehead on the western side of the Vistula, and they are extending it toward the road junction city of Kielce and toward the old Polish capital of Krakow. The latter is probably the direction in which the Russians are chiefly interested, as the road to Krakow is also the road to the great industrial district of Silesia, now one of the major pillars of the German war effort. It is, therefore, not surprising to learn from yesterday's Russian communique that heavy counterattacks by German tanks and infantry are taking place against this Russian bridgehead. Still farther south, along the Carpathian foothills, the Russians have made local advances. The Germans appear to be trying to create the impression that the Russians in this area are intending to force their way across the mountain passes into Slovakia and Hungary. No doubt the Germans think this is good propaganda to make the Slovaks and Hungarians fight harder on the German side. But it seems to be scaring both the Slovaks and the Hungarians out of their senses, or perhaps it back into some approach to common sense, as there have been persistent reports all week of separate peace moves and political shake-ups in both countries. The Russians have not officially indicated any mountain-crossing intentions so far in this Carpathian area. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
Major George Fielding Elliott has just given you an analysis of the military situation on the Eastern Front. German armies in Italy, their morale bolstered by a proclamation by Adolf Hitler himself telling them that the Nazis will be ready to assume the offensive in 6 weeks, sent many patrols probing into the Allied lines south of the Arno River today. And American heavy bombers from the Mediterranean again attacked the southern French coast. For details and other news from the Italian front, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
Our air attacks against the French and Italian Rivieras continue. Against gun positions from Genoa to Marseille. Against railway yards and air force further inland. Liberators today struck at rail bridges across the lower Rhone River, while other heavy bombers went out in force to raid coastal targets. Here in Rome, there has been no official hint as to the purpose of Prime Minister Churchill's visit to Italy. But the Italian papers are full of speculation and comment. Many of them take this occasion to lay the grievances of occupied Italy before the Prime Minister. Two papers address open appeals to Mr. Churchill. One of them suggests that Mr. Churchill take a motor trip from Rome to Naples to see, it says, whether we, the Italians, have suffered enough, and to decide whether we are still to be considered a conquered people. The Party of Action paper, in an open letter to Mr. Churchill, says, I quote, we should be lying both to ourselves and to you, our allies, if we said that all has gone well and the way to reconstruction of the country. We are still technically considered enemies of the United Nations, our liberator. The Socialist paper today says that relations between the Allies and Italy are getting more and more strained. There are many signs, the paper says, that the policy of the Versailles Treaty is being applied in Italy today. In denouncing these signs, which may have fatal results, we socialists feel that we are doing our duty as Italians, as Democrats, as Europeans. As you see, political comment in the papers here is very candid, often very bitter. Nearly every day we read statements just as strong as these. The anti-fascist Italians who are thinking seriously about Italy's future are profoundly discouraged by our policy. Their leaders have a genuine desire to restore democracy in Italy. But after 20 years of fascism, they sometimes lack confidence in their ability to do the job. But this is not the only reason for their sense of frustration. The present Italian government has no real power. It must turn to the Allies for approval of every slightest thing it wants to do. It must get our permission to name a new prefect or department head or any senior civil or military officer. On the central issue of the monarchy versus the republic, we have asked the Italian government to wait until after the war. But events do not wait. Blocks form and forces begin to roll, and already Republican parties on the one hand and royalist groups on the other are beginning to close ranks and prepare for what seems today must be an inevitable conflict. This is Winston Burdett in Rome, returning you now to CBS in New York.
For a summary of the situation in the Pacific and an interview with a Marine from Hoboken, New Jersey, who had quite an experience on Guam, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
Here's a Marine corporal who found himself in a tight spot after killing several Jap from Guam. Played dead for 6 hours. He's here with me now, his arm and shoulder harnessed up, but otherwise looking like the pride of Hoboken, New Jersey, his home city. Marine Corporal Fred Hoffman, Jr. Corporal, the story starts when you were sent out on a forward post during the advance at Guam. Is that right?
That's right. They told us to dig in the best we could, and in case the Nips tried to come through, we were supposed to stop them. Four of us scooped out a shell hole and found some lumber and corrugated iron from the roof, and then we crawled in and got set for a night. I had the second watch. It must have been an hour later when I looked up and saw a Nip staring me right in the face. I had a 45 in my hand and I stuck it out right at him. Muzzle must have been only a foot from his face. He just kept staring at the pistol at me.
How do you figure he didn't do anything to stare at you?
Crazy, I guess. Anyway, I let five shots go right in his pistol and he dropped. Then I turned around and yelled to the guys, but everybody was already awake. No sooner had I turned back around than there was another net right alongside the first one. I shot him with a carbine.
Someone had a lot of commotion out in front.
We looked out and saw about 15 nips, maybe more, there in the moonlight. We didn't shoot because they'd see our fire, and anyway, we figured to wait for them to come up and we could pick them off one at a time.
They start coming at you?
Everything was quiet for a while, and then they tossed a grenade and it hit the front protection and didn't do any damage. Mickey Kuzniak, the section leader, handed me a grenade and says, heave it out. I heaved it, and we heard a lot of moans, so I must have got quite a few of them. Then they threw another one at us, but it hit outside again. Then they all came charging at a hole, yelling like hell. They came right up and then kept running around like a bunch of kids, yelling all the time. Then one of them rolled a grenade in and Mickey hollered, grenade in the hole.
What'd you do then?
I rolled quick on my side to protect my face and went off onto my right shoulder. Shook me up and then I felt the body oozing out.
Did it surprise you that you could take a grenade without being killed?
All I thought it was done. I whispered down to Mickey and I said, I think I'll be gone in about 5 minutes. Mickey said, stay in there, Fred. Then I thought that if I lay in such a way to keep from losing blood, I might live, so I didn't move. The nips threw another grenade, and this one took off the target and I moved. Then they came up and jumped up and down on the 2x4s and yelled, but they didn't come in. They must have thought we were all four dead. Anyway, I had the idea of playing dead, and when one nip reached down and jabbed me with the butt of his rifle, I stayed with my eyes open and didn't move. He jabbed the bayonet into the legs of the runner, Ziyak, and I think he was stunned from the grenade. Anyway, he didn't move either. Then the nips took off.
Did they take off for good?
Not all of them. They tossed another grenade, but it landed outside. And two of them stayed. We could hear them talking, so we kept on playing dead. We could signal back and forth by squeezing. About 4:30, the Japs started retreating back through. When they glanced in, I kept staring, and they passed on by.
You didn't dare use the phone, I guess.
Right. We figured they'd hear us talking, and also it would be suicide for anybody to come up for us right then. About 5:30, we decided the Japs had retreated, and we phoned. In half an hour, medical Coleman and stretcher boys were up with plasma and a jeep.
Were you glad to see them?
Are you kidding? We near burst out crying. We were so glad.
Well, Fred, your folks and your girl back there in Hoboken, New Jersey, will be glad to know that you're in fine condition. You've heard the story of Marine Corporal Fred Hoffman, Jr., wounded at Guam. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
For Homefront News and an interview with the skipper of a Navy Night Patrol Bomber Squadron, Admiral takes you now to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
The War Production Board's fourth reconversion order is expected to be issued tomorrow, permitting limited and very limited production of civilian goods. Plans for the Russian-British-American Conference on a World Peace Organization are almost complete. The British delegation arrived here last night. The conference will open next Monday. On Capitol Hill, the House is expected to pass legislation this week to govern the disposal of surplus war property. And next week, it will take up the controversial George Bill for demobilization and unemployment compensation. Just as a reminder that there's still a war in the South and Southwest Pacific, here's Lieutenant Commander Eugene P. Rankin, USN, of Sepulpa, Oklahoma, the skipper of Rankin's Raiders, a famous Black Cat squadron of Navy patrol bombers. He and his men have just come back after 7 months of hard flying with one of the finest records in the Navy. Commander Rankin, how many hours of flying did you say your squadron did out there?
About 7,500, and 4,500 of those were at night. Of course, flying at night is the principal job of the Black Cats.
And just what is a Black Cat?
It's a Catalina flying boat painted jet black. The Black Cat was originated at Guadalcanal to fly night search missions for the Tokyo Express, to keep the Japs on Munda and other islands awake by dropping bombs, empty beer bottles, pieces of junk, and anything else that was handy. My squadron was the third Black Cat outfit to go out. By that time, the job had changed quite a lot.
Well, how do you mean it had changed?
By that time, the Tokyo Express had been pretty badly mauled, so our principal job was to find Jap barges and knock them out along the coast of Bougainville. And finally, all the way up through New Ireland and Caribbean. We also spotted for bombardments, flew cover for convoys and task forces, and in general, kept the Japs stirred up as much as possible.
Was all of your combat flying at night?
Oh, no. During the last 2 months of 1943, we flew mostly search missions, both day and night. Our real Black Cat operation started in January when we perfected a system of teamwork with the PT boats and destroyers.
Well, how did that work?
Well, I'll give you an example. One dark night, Lieutenant S.L. Lanier of Besma, Alabama, ran into four Jap barges and a gunboat off the coast of Bougainville. He called the PTs, which were patrolling off the shore, and they answered, "Roger, be right over there in about 2 minutes." Meanwhile, the Black Cat streaked the barges, trying to slow them down. When the PTs got there, they joined in the fight. But the Black Cat's port engine was shot out by the gunboat, and two of the PTs were pretty badly damaged. Between them, they sank three of the barges, and they couldn't finish the job. Lanier had to fly 75 miles back home on one engine, but meanwhile, he called in the destroyers, and the next day, they polished off the gunboat.
Well, that's real teamwork. Commander, is that kind of thing still going on in the Solomons?
Oh, yes. There are still 30 or 35,000 Japs around there, you know. Of course, they're getting a little punch-drunk by now, I guess. Toward the end, we were flying all the way up to New Britain, New Ireland, and Caribbean. We covered the landings at Emerald.
With Catalinas?
Yes, all the way from Emerald. That's a long way. We kept that up for 5 weeks, covering the task forces, the landings, and the convoys. We would take off at 3 p.m. and get back at noon the next day.
And Commander Rankin says that the only stop they made on that trip was one at Green Island to refuel. For all that, and despite 100 other close shaves and adventures that we haven't time now to tell, Lieutenant Commander Rankin and his Rankin's Raiders never lost a single plane or a single man in 7 months of flying. That's a record to be proud of. I return you to Admiral in New York.
From Portland, Oregon, comes word that after escaping capture on Jap-held Guam for 31 months, Chief Radio Man George Ray Tweed was nearly killed by a Jap sniper on Saipan after his rescue by an American battleship. Tweed and a Marine captain were riding along a dusty road when machine gun bullets whizzed past Tweed's ear, so close that he had to feel to make sure it was still there. They scampered to cover by the roadside, where two embarrassed Marines were very happy to see them. Marines asked, "Would you mind sticking around for a while and maybe taking a crack at the bushes where the sniper is?" Tweed, a crack shot, was delighted. He hates Japs with a vehemence, startling when one knows his natural modesty and quiet good humor. He said, "I got a good bead on the bushes and was just waiting for a movement when some men who had circled around behind him blew his head off. Then he was a good Jap." Tweed says, "If the Navy assigns him back to sea duty, he'll ask for the Central Pacific again." One more item. In China, fighting in Hunan province has raged with undiminished fury today, with the Japanese in possession of the vital rail city of Hongyang. Heavy fighting is reported in and around the perimeter of province towns on the north and south of the city, where the Chinese hope to forestall Japanese conquest of the Canton to Hankow Railway. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
We've been talking for some months about the Admiral's two-temperature refrigerator to be presented to America after victory has been won. But the other day, someone asked, "What do you mean, a two-temperature refrigerator?" Well, we thought it was self-explanatory. Two-temperature means simply that there will be two completely different temperatures in the two separate compartments of the Admiral refrigerator, a temperate, moist, cold in the spacious, regular compartment, and a dry, arctic cold in the home freezer compartment. The first compartment, with its purified, moist cold, is for the storage of foods that require above-freezing temperatures. This compartment will have no space-stealing, frost-collecting coils to rob the moisture from foods, and it will need no defrosting ever. And foods will stay fresh and appetizing without covered dishes. The second compartment is a built-in home freezer for quick freezing your own foods or for storing commercially frozen products. This is what we mean when we say the Admiral two-temperature refrigerator is the first major advancement in home refrigeration in many years. And behind it is all the know-how, all the prestige, and the precision production methods of the makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. If America is to prepare enough nurses to maintain essential civilian nursing services and meet the future needs of the armed forces, the U.S. Public Health Service must enroll 60,000 cadet nurses this year. You may write to U.S. Cadet Nurse Corps, Box 88, New York City, for full information. Answer your country's call. Be a cadet nurse. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Dr. Benjamin Ordway is the kindly but shrewd crime doctor. His methods of tracking down a criminal are almost uncanny.